All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeart Radio.
There he is.
Hello. How you doing?
Hello there.
What's going on, Real?
What's happening?
All right. I know you got limited time, so I want to start the clock immediately because we got a quadrillion questions. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm Questlove. We are here with Team Supreme. Sugar Steve in the house.
Hello, how are you? Congratulations on Sundance. Hello, Reverend Al.
Hello there.
That's right. Reverend Al, also star of Summer of Soul. I forgot. Laia, how are you?
Congratulations, but power to the people. The people got the power. Reverend Al is here.
Yes, absolutely. Bayville, how are
I'm
you?
I'm here. Sir? I'm fantastic. I'm a little in awe. Fine. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Fon Tigolo from North Cathedral.
Brother. Yes, indeed. Yeah, awesome. Man. You just call it North Carolina. No one calls it North Carolina.
No one
Cacolat.
Says North Carolina. Like,
nobody. Nobody.
That's like no one says New York like, City either.
Yeah, it's like people saying Philadelphia or Illa Fresh or Philadelphia, whatever. It's just, yeah. No one says North Carolina. North Carolina's fine.
No, okay. Noted. People, we cannot call North Carolina North Cacolat.
All right. So our guest today... how shall I say, our guest today is cut from a rare cloth, the cloth of justice. He's a gentleman who at the ripe age of 4 knew what his calling was. I believe that at the age of 4 my parents allowed me to watch Soul Train unchaperoned. So that should give me some comparisons. Anyway, he was practically baptized in the civil rights movement, appointed as leader of the youth movement from the one and only Jesse Jackson's Operation Breadbasket. Our guest today is literally Black Ghostbusters, the person
he's Black History.
Who you gonna call?
Exactly. Yes. The person whom you call when it's time to put wheels.
When them white folks start tripping.
Exactly. into motion, bringing attention to justice, name it. He's there literally on the front lines. The always exciting, never a loss of words or the right words, always there on the front lines. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Questlove Supreme, the one and only Reverend Al Sharpton.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
We made it.
How are you today? How are you today?
I'm doing good. I'm doing very well. And congratulations on Summer Soul. You really did a masterpiece on that.
Wow. I appreciate that. But I got to ask you, and I'm a self-admitted former reluctant leader. How hard is it to still want to lead and be on the front lines and always have the answers? Because there's many a day where I mean, my version of leading is more like
not even close.
Make it a music edit or having a lunch with somebody, but you know, not to your level, but still. Like once you decide that that's the path that your life is on, you gotta see it through. And what makes you get out of bed every morning to fulfill this role?
I think that I put it this way: Michael Brown, who was killed by police in Ferguson's mother, spoke one night, and she said something that clicked with me. She said that Mark Twain, and you gotta remember, we're in the middle of this whole battle in Ferguson. And for the mother of a victim to quote Mark Twain was like, what? What is she getting ready to do? And she said, Mark Twain said something that she never forgot. She said, the two most important moments in your life is the moment you're born and the moment you find out why you were born. And that's what clicks with me. I believe I was born to do what I do. I've been doing it since I was four. Like you said, I started preaching as a kid in the Pentecostal church. I became Jesse and Bill Jones youth director at 12. So I don't know nothing else. And even as I got older and got around James Brown and others in entertainment, I kept going back to activism. James Brown would say, he can't make a living doing that. He'll be back out here. And I wouldn't go back because that's where my comfort zone was. And as you have developed into a leader, you can drop the reluctant. You do it questioning yourself, but you do it because you can't do anything else because that has become you. And people look for you to do that. And what you are ambiguous about, that ambiguity is what attracts people because they know you don't have an agenda. You're doing it from your heart.
Wow. Okay. I got to take that. So there's never a time where you feel like, you know, where you're in a situation and you don't know the right words to say or, okay, there's a moment. Let me back up. So there's a moment that President Obama told me about in which he knew that he was going to do that, the funeral service for in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. The folks from the church.
Yeah, Charleston.
Yeah, in Charleston. He knew he was going to do that service. And with a good 8-day lead, he knew that... you know, he crafted the perfect speech that he felt that was going to fit the tone. And he said like 3 minutes into that speech, he knew that wasn't the tone and he didn't know what to do. And he just like took a breath and something said, just start singing Amazing Grace. And it was a risk for him, but he did it and it opened the people up. So I'm just saying like in leading some oftentimes you have to think on your feet in real time. How does that come to you? I think I come from a place where like we now have to watch our words and I don't want to get canceled. I don't want to say the wrong thing. So, you know, I often get caught in my head and leading because you don't want to say the wrong thing because of the repercussions. But how do you get over that?
I think you go with the flow and the energy and no matter how much you plan. And all of us are worried about, if I say this wrong, am I going to hurt the cause? Am I going to hurt the family I'm representing? Am I going to hurt the organization? But then you get in an energy and you just flow. I'll give you an example. President Obama told me the same story about Amazing Grace. I was in the audience that day. It worked. And I didn't know that he didn't plan it. But when I walked on the pulpit to preach George Floyd's funeral, I had no plans of doing that whole thing of get your knee off our neck. It just came as I was speaking and I just went with it and it worked and I just kept doing it then. And I think that you've got to be disciplined enough to put some borders on yourself in your own mind, but then free enough to say, I'm gonna press as far as I can inside these borders and let it flow. The advantage I had as starting as a boy preacher, the disadvantage is before I could read and write well, I was preaching. The advantage is I never learned how to use a manuscript. So I can't speak from a manuscript. That's why when I started my MSNBC show, hardest thing in the world for me was to speak with a teleprompter because I never read a sermon or a speech. So I'm like, I'm messing up Saturday Night Live, good all these things.
Yeah, that was
I never used a manuscript until I started on MSNBC. I was 57 years old learning how to speak and read at the same time.
Wait, so you saying you're a freestyler? You saying you freestyle for
I was freestyling before y'all called it freestyle. I was freestyling when we were still saying North Kakalaki.
Do you remember what you spoke about when you were four?
Yes.
And what was your parents' reaction to this? Like, or whoever was in charge of you speaking, how did they know that this four-year-old had the gumption or the right words to lead?
We had in the church what they called the junior usher board. That's the kids that would hand out the little programs and help seat people. It was a cute little thing to keep kids involved. Once a year, they'd have the junior usher board anniversary. So the adult supervisor said, what do y'all want to do at the anniversary? And it was about 10 of us. One of them was a guy who ended up being a pretty big singer, Ronnie Dyson. He was about 10 years old. Ronnie Dyson did Aquarius and Hair. He was a kid with me in Washington Temple Church in Brooklyn. He said that he wanted to read a poem. My sister wanted to sing. I said, I want to preach. So everybody laughed. The adult advisor said, let him preach. Maybe God's going to use him because this is a Pentecostal church. And my mother said, I prayed that God would use my son. My father said, oh, this is crazy. But they let me preach. And I preached at the anniversary, about 900 people there. They put me on a box because they couldn't see me up on the rostrum. And I preached from St. John's 14th chapter, let not your heart be troubled. And I've been preaching ever since. By the time I was seven, I was doing the youth days in other churches. By the time I was nine, they did the World's Fair in New York, and they put me up to preach before Mahalia Jackson. That's why I loved A Soul Summer so, because I ended up doing two or three cities with Mahalia, and the rest was history. That's how Jesse and them heard of me. I was called a wonder boy preacher.
Wow. Okay.
So how would you figure out what your sermons was going
to
be?
I would listen to older ministers, because I grew up in Pentecostal church. We was in church all the time, and I would, in many ways, just preach back what I heard out of memory. And and I could put the sermons together in my head.
Wow. Do you have any like the recordings of your sermons as a kid? Have you kept track of
those? I
have
one when I was nine. When I was nine, they did a 45 record of me preaching. And this guy that was a radio guy at the time, Doc Wheeler, made a record. I have that, a little 45 record of me preaching. And I was doing more, you know, going back to what I heard other preachers did, and then you go through the holler and the shout. And because you was cute, you got away with it. When you got older, you had to say something. You get away with a lot when you're 9, 10, 11 years old.
Facts. Hey,
can you explain to me, I know that you're a Pentecostal preacher, but what are the exact, what are the difference between
Pentecostal Baptist, Kojic,
or... you know, the various, because I just thought like Southern preaching was one thing.
Yeah, well, I was raised by Southern parents, though. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. Kojic, which I grew up in until I was like 14, then I went Baptist. Kojic was more grassroots, what James would call gut bucket. We would do the singing and the shouting and the hallelujah dance. Baptist was a little more refined, and Methodist was even more refined. It's a matter of style. It's a matter of music. Like, I remember when in some big Baptist churches when I was growing up, you wouldn't have drums in the church. You wouldn't have choirs that would sing emotional songs. So when I would go to Baptist churches and Methodist church, they'd be singing anthems. We didn't do that. All of our stuff was Shirley Caesar kind of singing. And then you got more refined with the Baptist. So it's more cultural and class. Grassroots people were more the Pentecostals. And as I grew up and then got in the civil rights movement when I was 12, they were all Baptists. And then I later became Baptist. I was rebaptized to Baptist, and they were a little more learned. We were all spirit. And that's probably why I gravitated so to James, because James was a secular version of the Holy Roller. I mean, what James would do wasn't much different than we do in the choir in the Holiness Church.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Where were your parents from? You said they were from the South.
Mother's from Dothan, Alabama. She passed. My father was from Eufaula, Alabama. Neither one of them is on the map.
Man.
Wow. Wait, what city is that?
Dothan Motor Company.
Alabama.
Dothan's the name.
You follow Florida.
I love that name.
You follow Alabama. Okay. Okay, as a musician, I do want to know, like right now, as a record collector, I'm kind of on my 70s gospel kick right now, and I'm noticing that it's very rare to find like gospel records that have like a certain groove to it or a certain soul to it. And I realize that a lot of it is that, you know, they thought it was sinful or whatever, but, you know, knowing that you're cut from the cloth of the James Brown shadow, if you will, how hard was it for kind of secular sounding music to finally break through to the black church where it wasn't considered sinful or that sort of thing? Because even when I was drumming in church, like if I started playing too good, I would get looks from like the elders, like, you're playing that rap music. Like I know that you're playing Run DMC right now. Like that sort of thing. Like,
right.
No,
it was hard. I remember that in the early days of the 60s, when I was still like 8 or 9, and Sam Cooke left the church, because Sam Cooke started with a gospel group, and right. He left and started singing secular. They said, oh, he's backslid. He's going to hell. And Little Richard would go in and out. And after a while, people would be in and out. Ronnie was in and out, Ronnie Dyson. And after a while, people started getting comfortable that it was all right. It became all right because those of us that was kids got old and we didn't see the difference. But it was a lot of tension. You're right. If I would go to a political rally when I was 12, I'd backslid. You in the world. You were supposed to deal with going to heaven, nothing on earth. So it was the same in the music. It was the same in our social life. But this was the era where Dr. King had got killed. It was a Black Power era. I was still 13 years old, and I wanted to be with my contemporaries, and we were activists. And many of them didn't stay in activism like I did, but that was a time where everybody was a member of something. You were either with us with Dr. King, or you were with the Panthers, which were more militant, or you joined the Nation of Islam. But everybody in New York was something, and your whole life was around what you were a member of. What girls you dated was based on what what silo you were in, and the church had to make adjustments to that because people started changing. When I was first starting the Pentecostal church, it was a sin for women to wear lipstick or pants, and I remember we went to Detroit. Yep. Yeah, I remember we went to Detroit to speak at a youth convention, and I saw my bishop's wife come out of the motel with some slacks on. And I called my mother collector and said, Madam Washington's going to hell. She's wearing pants.
Tattletale.
My mother got mad at me for calling her collector to rat out.
Wow. Oh, man.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonsigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit Bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Okay, so as of this recording, we're a few days ahead of the passing of the infamous Danny Ray, James Brown's
announcer,
MC, his mouthpiece, his Paul Revere. Can you talk? When's the first time you met James Brown, and what was that like?
All right, when we were growing up, when I started growing up, I was born in Brooklyn. Like I said, my father had a successful business, and he bought a house in Hollis, Queens. At that time, we thought Queens, Hollis was like the suburbs. And James Brown had a big mansion in St. Albans. And all the kids in the neighborhood would go over and stand outside the gate wanting to see James Brown. So he was my hero. My father did his hair like James Brown, but I never met him. So fast forward, I'm now known as a teenage preacher. And I had a youth movement that you mentioned, Questlove, and a kid came and joined the youth movement, same age as me, and said he was from the South. He came to New York. He wanted to go to Columbia to go to law school. And he joined my youth group. His name was Teddy. He ended up being James Brown's son. And about 7 months after he was in our youth group trying to get in law school, he got killed in a car accident in Albany. He was driving with some friends, and Teddy got killed. James was having problems then because he had endorsed, this is 73, I'm 18 now, and he had endorsed the year before Richard Nixon for president. And a lot of the brothers was mad at him for going with Nixon. He was a sellout and all. And they picketed him when he was at the Apollo in 72. When Teddy got killed the next year, he came to New York about Teddy, and the lead disc jockey in New York at that time was Hank Spann on WWRL AM. This is before FM got big.
It's before BLS. Okay.
And right. And Hank Spann told him, he said, if you want to do something in memory of your son, your son joined this little youth group with this young preacher, you should do something for them, and nobody will pick at you because everybody likes this little kid running around being a civil rights guy. And they set up for me to meet James Brown at his office on 1700 Broadway. And I went in, I'm meeting God. That's why I told you the whole background of, I stand at his gate. And James Brown looked at me, and he looked me up and down, and he started talking, and you had no idea what he was talking about. And he was like, he's looking at me, well, you know, if you do it, I tell you to do it, I'm going to do it, blah, 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 and all of that. And finally, he shook my hand, which was dismissing me. So when we got outside, I told the youth with me, I think he said he's going to do the show. So he told me what to do, how to pass out the flyers, how to promote. Hank Spann pumped it up. And we did it at the RKO Albee Theater downtown Brooklyn, which is now the Albee Square Mall, but it used to be a theater there. And they had about 2,000 seats. And two shows was going to sell out 4,000 seats. Now, I didn't know they had picketed James Brown, and I didn't know that they were worried about what was going to happen. I went out there and did everything he said, and he pulls up that night in 73 in the limousine, and he jumps out the limousine in the driveway behind the backstage, and he looks at his manager, Mr. Bobbitt. Mr. Bobbitt, how'd they do? And Mr. Bobbitt said, they sold every ticket out, and there's about 500 people outside. He said, what? He said, yeah. And he told me, you come with me, son. And I walked behind James Brown in the building, and he went and combed his hair out, and he's talking. And again, I don't know what he's saying. And he gets ready to go on stage. Danny Ray is introducing him. The band had hit. People are screaming. And he walks on the stage in the wings at my show. Now, mind you, I'm 18 years old, was Miles Davis. And Miles had come to see James perform. And I'm standing there between James Brown and Miles Davis. Mm-mm. And I thought I had died and went to heaven. And the middle of the show, James stopped the music. I think he had done Try Me or something that was slow. And he stopped and told the band, cut it. And they stopped. And he called me out. He said, I want to bring out this young man who made the night happen. His youth movement, y'all helped. My son was a part. And I want him to lead us in prayer in memory of my son. So I'm like nervous. I'm used to every pulpit, but I've never been on a show business stage. I walk out to the mic and I look at him and he said, pray, go on and pray. You know how to pray, don't you? I started praying. And when I came off, James Brown sent for me in his dressing room after the show. And he was sitting on the hairdryer because he would always have this habit till he died. After every show, he'd roll his hair back up. And I start talking to him, and I'm trying to, communicate with him. And he's like the hairdryer making all this noise. He kept, huh? What you say, huh? And he finally said to me, I'll be back in New York in 2 or 3 weeks. I'm going to plan your career. And I met him in his office, and he said, I'm going to take you with me to California. I said, to California? He said, yeah. And we went to California. He took me with him to do Soul Train. And he said to Don Cornelius, Mr. Cornelius, he said, I want you to meet this young man. He's a teenager. I want him to give me an award on Soul Train. By then, he had the big payback out. And he said, Don Cornelius said, we don't do awards on this show. And he said, Mr. Cornelius, do you know how to sing Payback? And Don Cornelius said, no, you do that. He said, well, you're going to sing it unless you let this kid give me this award. And I went on Soul Train. And I went on Soul Train, gave Jay Brown this award. I was the biggest guy in Brooklyn there because now all the girls that wouldn't give me a date because who wants to date a preacher?
Right.
Wanted to date me because I was on Soul Train with Jay Brown. And I became, in many ways, like Teddy because I was the same age, ambitious. I reminded him of the son he lost. And he became the father that I didn't have because my father left us when I was about 12 and we moved back to Brooklyn. We're in the projects, mother on welfare. And James started taking me around the world and he kept saying, I want you to stay in the ministry. I promised your mother you wouldn't leave the church. So he'd send me home for me to preach, do my youth work, send back for me. And he became like a father figure to me.
Wow.
Wow.
That's an incredible story.
And I
wanted
Googling.
To know how you got on. So okay, now I get it. I get it now.
So when did I'm just curious, since I know you guys had the father relationship, but you politically you were growing and you were growing further and further apart. So did you just how did that work? Did y'all have conversation? Did you not feel
we would argue? James Brown was a very conservative guy and to the right of the right.
Yeah.
And from Augusta, Georgia, he was a Southern conservative guy. And he didn't believe in non, but he used to always say to me, I don't know what you're doing all that marching. James Brown always had one or two guns with him. That's what you need, bro.
Well.
And he was a regular country guy like that. But we would debate and argue, but he had this liking for me. So he would always explain to his guys, Reverend is more militant, but that's my son. And he would take me in these rooms. And as I got known, he would tell people, y'all got to accept Reverend. I'm talking about a lot of the whites, because he take me to crossover shows. I never forget, later in his life, they gave him the Kennedy Center Award. Mm-hmm. And he had made them have me write the liner notes in the program. And when I got there that night to the Kennedy Center, it was George Bush was president. He was in, you know, the president's, whatever they call that, where you sit up in the booth. Mm-hmm. And right. And next to him, the box, they call it, the presidential box. Next to him was Colin Powell. And then there was the guest. And James Brown said, give Reverend the box. So these people all nervous, said, Mr. Brown. Now, he's being honored. Carol Burnett, him, they always do five. Said, Mr. Brown, Reverend Sharpton's running for president and the Democrats against Mr. Bush. We can't do that. He says, you're going to do it tonight. And I'm sitting up there in the box now. running against Bush. And Bush is two or three people down. So in the intermission, we all go in this little VIP area. Only the president could go and honorees and their guests. And I come in, and this is how James Brown was. James Brown stood there, looked at me. President stayed over there. He said, Mr. Bush. And George Bush comes over and he says, Mr. Brown, honored to have you with us tonight. He says, look here, I know you and the Reverend got y'all's differences, but it's music tonight. Differences? I'm calling this man. But James Brown, none of that mattered. James Brown, he going to tell the president what he going to do. And George Bush and I later in life would laugh about that. Every time I see George Bush, he said, did you ever tell anybody about James Brown and me and you at the Kennedy Center? I said, yeah.
Wow.
Wait, can I ask? Okay, so James Brown won't be the first or the last. I mean, I guess the paraphrase term is the rags to riches story that has probably more conservative leanings, even though, you know, they say they're of the people, but has more conservative leanings. And
he just said it out loud.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that what I noticed about this past election we just had, the amount of rappers that were kind of going down the same path.
Mm, mm-hmm.
This thing of like pull yourself up by the bootstraps and, you know, if I do it, you can do it. What do you think is the mindset that produces that? I guess from him, it's like I worked hard to get here and everyone should follow my path. Or is that like where he was coming from?
I think that it is some of that. A lot of it is that I worked hard, you can work hard. And some of that is that they just were afraid it would interfere with where they were trying to go. But the problem that they had with James is as conservative as he was politically, he had this real streak of black in him. And he refused, his music kept him black. And he wouldn't apologize for his blackness. And I think that was the difference. Because I would go with him places and they would tell him, I was with him one night, he went to do the Tonight Show. And they went to do the sound check. And he did the sound check like he was at the Apollo. And the guy told him, said, Mr. Brown, you're going to have to water it down. Our kind of audience is a little, you know, kind of tell mm-hmm. them that, you know, they wouldn't, it's too hard hit. And I'll never forget, and this is why I love James Brown, despite his politics, and I love him because he was like a father. He looked at the guy, he said, if you wanted Sammy Davis, you should have booked him. He said, you're going to get James Brown tonight. And that's what he did.
I love it.
And that's really, in many ways, what he would put in me. He said, I want you to be your own style. He said, whatever you do, we used to ride around. He had about 32, 33 cars at his estate. We'd always be riding around one of his cars. I think one reason he liked me, he had a kids, but a lot of his kids didn't hang around them. His daughters were still very young. And I used to want to hear all the stories and all the advice because he talked incessantly. And his other sons that were, you know, younger than Teddy, but almost my age, they wanted to get away. They didn't want to hear the lectures. I wanted all of it. And we just ride around in the dark because there wasn't no street lights in the woods where James Brown's estate is. And he would be talking to me. I remember he stopped one night and he said to me, I wasn't no more than 21, 22 then. He said, Reverend, because everybody was surnamed. He believed in that respect thing. He said, Reverend, I want you to promise me one thing. I said, what's that? He said, promise me you'll never be one of the boys. He said, I know you're a preacher. I know you're civil rights, but don't be like none of them. Be different. He said, I always am different. When I do my first two chords of a song, they know that's James Brown. Don't nobody sound like me. And he pulled up in a parking lot next to Daddy Grace's church in Augusta, Georgia. And we just sat there. And I'm like, what are we doing here? And after about a minute or two, he says, you hear that? I said, hear what? He said, that. I said, I don't hear nothing but they having church inside. He said, listen to that drum. And I listened. And I said, yeah, I hear. He says, that's where I learned the sound. They're on the one. He said, I'm on a 1-3 beat. Everybody else is on a 2-4 beat. Learn how to be on the one. Set your own beat. He said, and if you set your own beat, people always remember you. And you do your own style. And when I started a lot of activism, in-your-face kind of activism, and people used to say, oh, he was too bold. Why am I marching in Bensonhurst? Why am I doing this? You could put out a press release and make a statement. I got that from James Brown. I developed my own style. I took a lot of flack, but my father figure told me I had to be different and bold, and I did that. And he used to laugh, saying, Reb is just doing the James Brown and civil rights. The rest of them bourgeois Negroes don't know. He said he's doing the raw stuff. He's raw. He's raw.
Word.
I remember we were in his office. I'll tell you this story. We was in his office one day in 1982. And I had to come down to visit him. And he said, I hear y'all marching to try to get Dr. King a birthday holiday.
Yeah.
I said, you tight with the Republicans. Why don't you see if you can help us out? He said, I can go to the president whenever I want. And he hit his intercom. Secretary picks it up. Get the White House on the phone. It's about 11 o'clock in the morning. I said to myself, yeah, right. So we going through the day, went out, got something to eat, come back. About 4 o'clock, she hits the intercom and said, the White House is on the phone, Mr. Brown. I looked at him. I was a little shocked and impressed. He picks up the phone and he talks to them. Then he hangs up the phone and he looks at me. He says, January 15th is Dr. King's birthday.
Nuh-uh.
He invited me up.
Wow.
No! He said, no. They didn't get a holiday. They didn't get a holiday, but they agreed to meet with him that day. So I told him, are they just using you as a showpiece? He said, you're right. He says, and you're going with me. So I went back to New York. January 14th, he flew me to Augusta to fly back to Washington. I kept saying, I can meet you in Washington. I'm flying over Washington.
Right.
No, you got to fly with me. So we're in Delta Airlines because his private plane was in the shop. And we're sitting in the plane.
Wait, that's
right. My plane need a new alternator.
It's playing in the shop. It's playing in the shop. So we sitting in first class. His bodyguards and coach. We sitting there, and he looks at me when the plane levels off. He said, Reverend, I said, yes, sir. He said, I want you to do me a favor. I said, what's that? He said, when we land, we're going by Bobby Bennett's place. Bobby Bennett was one of the famous Flames who had stopped singing, but they were still cool. Right. And I said, oh, Mr. Bennett, okay, because I'd met him a couple of times. He'd come out to some of the shows. He said, Mr. Bennett, I want him to, he's going to tighten up my hair. I want him to do your hair like mine. I said, you want him to do what? He said, I want him to do your hair like mine. And I said, all right. Now, again, this is my father. My father never tried to get me to emulate nothing. So I'm like the abandoned son that found a man that really felt I was worthy of being like him. It was a real self-identity thing. Bobby Bennett did my hair and became, you know, I started wearing the comp. And we went and met with Ronald Reagan. When we came back from the White House, got in the plane, headed back to Augusta, plane levels off again. He said, I got one more favor, Reverend. I said, what's that? He said, I want you to wear your hair like that as long as I'm alive. And that's where I got the hairstyle from. And I never forget,
what?
Years later, when he got in trouble when he was old and went to jail, he would call me from the jail about 3 times a week. And you have to call collect because he's a prisoner. And they say, collect call from the South Carolina Correction Facility. Would you accept? And I'm halfway not being able to pay bills, but I'd have to take his call. I'd take the call. He would never ask me how my kids work. By then, I had 2 daughters, nothing. First question was, Reverend, how's your hair? because he was checking to see if I changed my hairstyle.
Stuck with it. Make sure you stuck with it.
And that's where the hairstyle from. And I took a lot of flack from a lot of the Afrocentric brothers.
Why but you sacrificed like for that? Us. But you sacrificed for us. Like it wouldn't be
but
no Martin Luther King holiday.
A father thing. It was, yeah. It was. I finally had a father in my life. I looked like my father. I didn't care what people said.
So how you, can I just ask you, Rev, since we're on the hair, you've had this hairstyle for such a long time.
Yeah, how do you maintain your hair now?
Yes,
yeah.
Because it's still beautiful.
What's your hair regimen now?
Yeah.
Those that know don't say, and those that say don't know.
Not even a grease. Yourself. You ain't even going to drop us a grease.
You ain't even no shea butter or nothing.
You ain't even going to take a style of that. That's the best secret.
You put no Dax on it, Rev. No birdies.
I mean, your edges are beautiful, so whatever. It is what it is.
You lay the edges down with a toothbrush, Rev. Right, let us know.
Oh, man. That's an incredible soundbite. Rev, I need to know. I think it's easier now because of social media and the internet. Okay, but pre-internet, let's say before 1997. I mean, even though the internet was out then, but it wasn't as viral. Mm. If one needs to contact you for assistance or your presence, how does one do that? And what is the thought process and the sort of decision making that you go through before you decide, yes, I'm going to take this on? Because I can imagine
a vetting process.
Actually, let me start with how many calls do you get every day on an average to take up a cause?
Well, before 97, I always, since 91, had an office. And I got that from James. James, you say you're not in business if you don't have an office. So I always had a staff. Started with two or three. Now we got offices in seven cities, regional offices. And no government money, we raise our money. And we have crisis departments that vet out cases. Usually a lawyer will call me because they want me to help publicize it. Like it started it with Vernon Mason would call me and say, something happened. Kid got killed in Howard Beach. We vetted it, they give us information. And I would go and say, we're gonna do a march. We're going out in the neighborhood. Now Ben Crump calls me, like he called me when George Floyd's family wanted to reach me. And, you know, that's one of the things that was always crazy to me. They would always say, well, Al Sharpton just wants publicity. That's why people called me, is they wanted me to blow it up. Nobody called me to keep a secret. So right. we would come in and we would decide that we thought it was legitimate and we'd rally people around it, because if you don't create that kind of drama, you will never create the media, because it wasn't social media. So other people said, it's a shame 1986, they killed this boy, Michael Griffith in Howard Beach, because he was black. And nobody knew what to do. I said, well, let's go out there. And they were saying, it might've been a mug, it might've been a love triangle. I said, if we march, everybody know what it is. What do you mean march? I said, we gotta go out there and dramatize. So I called a march, we went out there. As we start marching down the street, maybe about 500 of us, there must have been 700-800 whites start coming out, calling us the N-words, throwing bananas and everything at us. And I said, well, now everybody understand it's a race thing, because you bring it out. I knew if you go in certain sections, Bensonhurst, Lady with Yusuf Hawkins, they were going to make the case because they're going to react. And that became on television. You had to remember, I didn't come out of Georgia like Dr. King, or out of Chicago with Jesse. I come out of New York, you competing with Times Square, Statue of Liberty, Empire State Building, Wall Street. New York is used to everything. So you got to be dramatic to get attention on your cause. So people say I was flamboyant and bodacious. You had to be in New York. You can't send out a press release in New York and get attention. You got to do something. And that's what we would do. We would do things to grab the media attention. The outrageousness of it made the case, which changed the racial profiling laws. But you had to be able to dramatize. I remember when we was marching in Bensonhurst, when they killed Yusuf Hawkins, and they were throwing watermelons at us and calling us words. And one of them said, he's a guy stabbed me. And I remember I was marching locked arms with Yusuf Hawkins' brother. And he said, Reverend Al, you right. they're acting crazy. This is going to be wild on TV news tonight. They'll know now it was race to kill my brother. He said, this is going to be great. I said, yeah, if we live to the end of this watch, because they were so crazy, even I got nervous. But that's what you have to do. You've got to be able to strategically know how to raise the drama level. And that edge, you got to be real careful and disciplined about. And you got to be ready to be different. People would not do that. It was me learning the theatrics from James Brown, combining it with what I learned in the King movement, and trying to bring it up north.
So the question, that's interesting you say that, because one of the questions I have for you, because, you know, you are a reverend and you said, you know, that's your calling, but you are, you know, very much a celebrity as well. So how do you kind of walk that line between, you know, your ministry and your calling, but also having to be a public figure and, if not an outright entertainer, so to speak, but, you know, like you just said, you have to, you know, get people's attention. How have you walked that line throughout your career?
Because I always am honest with myself that I'm not an actor, I'm not a singer and dancer. My celebrity came from my activism, not my activism from
not
my
the other
celebrity.
Way around.
A lot of celebrities try to act like activists. I do what I believe in, and I won't do it if I don't believe in it. I'm the kind of person that's very disciplined like that. And I remind myself, kid, you grown up broken home on welfare in Brooklyn, that only God could have put me where I am, and he put me there for a reason, and I don't want to get him to drop me for forgetting the reason I'm there. When James Brown and others tried to get me to just, you can drop that, you can do entertainment, no, I got to do this. This is what I'm, I would have never known you, Mr. Brown, if it wasn't for God, and I really believe that.
Yeah, when you talk about, you know, doing, you know, getting behind stuff that you believe in, do you think in any way, like the Tawana Brawley case, did that change, I guess, the way you would vet things, you know, in your career? You know what I'm
Absolutely.
Saying? How did that affect
you? When the lawyers called me about Brawley, and I was out there 3 or 4 months after, you know, they had started the case and was moving, I went on the lawyer's word, and I believed them. And I believed this girl. Why wouldn't I? You got people mm-hmm. now that believe when people say things and win a Me Too era. Right. But I learned from that to vet it more carefully. So that every I is dotted, every T is crossed to the best of your ability. You never know all the way what somebody's going to do. Because a year after I got in Brawley, I stood up for 5 kids accused of a rape in Central Park that mm-hmm. they confessed to. I ended up right on that one. Right. They say I was wrong on Brawley. It all happened within the same year. So you're taking a leap of faith, but I learned not to take crazy leaps. Try to vet it as much as you can. And be careful, because you don't want to discredit the movement by getting in situations that blow up in your face. Like right now, we have 3 policemen indicted for killing George Floyd. We don't know what the jury's going to do when they go to trial. We went and helped blow up Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman got acquitted. And some people will say I was wrong on Zimmerman. They said he was not guilty. But Trayvon Martin is dead. So you've got to be willing to stick in there and take the bad days with the good, but make sure your intentions are good and right, and that you're as careful as you could be, which is why I've not gotten any cases like that since, because I vetted, even if a lawyer brings it to me, I vetted as much as I can. Like, I'm a prosecutor. I want to know every angle.
That's what's up.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
My question is... There's, you know, we're going all over the place now. In 2004, when you decide, what made you decide to try to run for president in 2004?
I looked at the fact that in 84 and 88, Jesse had run and had really moved the party more toward the left, what we believed in. And nobody had picked that up. And I'm looking at the fact that we had just come out of the war in Iraq, and there were people that had moved the party to the right. If you remember, Clinton and them were triangular, and they were like almost centrist. And I wanted to run to get into debates to bring up racial profiling, to bring up police misconduct and how the war in Iraq was wrong. So I ran to try to be on the stage to get a national hearing on our issues. And that's what I did. And in the debates, I would bring up stuff that nobody would bring up, which they had to deal with race, they had to deal with policing, they had to deal with Iraq. And I knew I wasn't going to win, but I won because I made those those issues become central. And I got a good vote. And that is when mainstream white America started saying that, he's not just some guy out there angry, he really knows the issues. But the point was, if we could get on the mainstream stage and argue our issues, we could affect policy. And that's why I ran.
Can I ask you, it's interesting because the issue recently came up. I was watching a new show about Van Jones, and I love the way you ride your relationships, because you were just talking earlier about how, of course, you ran against Bush. Your relationship is not the same with Bush as it was then. Relationship is not the same with a lot of people, right? Clinton's. Right. How do you walk this line? I mean, in the Van Jones comparison, some people were saying, well, why are you in pictures with this person? You know, that doesn't happen with Al Sharpton, right? Like, everything seems to be very planned out in a way, but yet you still work together. So can you kind of break that down?
Because you got to let them know it's not personal, but just like you got your beliefs, I have mine. So Donald Trump, I knew in New York, I marched on him about Central Park. Then he tried that. He was Democrat when Dinkins was in. But when Trump won, about a month after he won, he called me. I'd been on Morning Joe that morning, and Joe asked me about Trump. He said, you know him, you fought with him, and then he tried to be friendly. And I said, well, you got to understand New York to understand Donald Trump. And I explained Trump was an out-of-borough guy in the Queens, born to money, but he wasn't part of the established. He wasn't at the power spots. So he had this chip on his shoulder that the Park Avenue guys looked down on him and his father. And he was able to translate that to a lot of white, blue collar working class people who he never was, but he wasn't part of the accepted Rothschilds of the world.
He was able to sell it to them.
Yeah. Right. So when I got off the show, this is about December 1st, I think, 2013. And when I got off the show, no, 2016 when he ran. And, I was in a board meeting of National Action Network, my organization, and my cell phone rang, and I looked down. I didn't know the number, and I had it on silencer, so I let it ring. It rang again, so I said, maybe something happened. So I picked up the phone and whispered, I'm in a board meeting. Call me later. whoever this is, because I didn't know the number. And a voice said, can you hold on for the president-elect? And I said, huh? They said, can you hold on for the president-elect? So I put my finger up like I'm in church, and I walk out the boardroom, and I go in the hall of where we were, and Trump comes on, Al, I saw you this morning on Morning Joe. You got me. You're right. I was an outsider. And look at me now. I'm the president-elect of the United States. Can you believe it? I said, no, I am having a hard time believing it. He said, look at you. You got a TV show, but you're still marching. They never thought either one of us would be anything. He says, I want you to come to Mar-a-Lago. We're going to talk. I said, I'm not doing that. He said, wait a minute. I said, I'm not doing that. I said, in all due respect, you will not do the photo op with me. We're not going
to
do that.
A lot of people came to Trump Tower in those first months.
Not me. I will not do it. And the whole time he was in, he called me two or three times, and I wouldn't go to the White House and all, because I understand from my background growing up in both the church and in show business, optics are important.
Everything.
And you give them the photo, they use it whatever way they want. And I would not give him that photo.
How dismaying was it to see that photo when he had the the 50 black preachers or whatever, or just general, how dismaying was it to see how easy it was to be, I'm assuming,
bought.
How dismaying was it to see that?
It was disheartening because you know that he's using you. And knowing Donald Trump, he probably didn't give people that much. People get all enthralled just to go to the White House. And the advantage I had, Questlove, is by growing up around people like Jesse and like James Brown, I wasn't impressed with all that. I've been to the White House. I could take 4 years not going to the White House. But a lot of them had never been invited before, and to stand there with the president, it didn't mean nothing to me. They're going to be a new president in 4 years. Joe Biden and I talk, but Joe Biden will be gone in 4 years from the White House. I'll be Al Sharpton as long as I live. I'm going to stand for what I stand for. I'm not going to give that up for some temporary photo op. And I think, and I tell a lot of those people that, is don't play yourself like that. They need you and will discard you when they don't need you. It ain't personal. The cause is bigger than all of us.
Were there certain preachers or community leaders that you knew that were considering that you personally had to talk out of doing that?
I talked to one or two that I talked out of, and I talked to one that I couldn't talk out of. And I won't, you know, give up their name.
Yeah, you have to say
that. But I would tell them, I know Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a user, and he will drop you and as soon as the photo's over, which he did. And look what he did to his own buddies. He let a lot of them get indicted. And all. He pardoned some of them. I mean, that's who he is. And you don't ever deal with a guy like that. He has no ethics.
Reverend Al, can you please give us the backstory, your idea of the backstory behind some of these pardons? I'm confused.
I think that he felt that if he pardoned some of them, my honest to God belief is that he was looking out for him, thinking that they would not sit up in jail and tell on him, because now he can be prosecuted on a state level.
And a little Wayne Kodak.
I think he did that to cover the fact that he let Lil Wayne and Kodak go, and then to let 20 of his boys go. So he was trying to act like he was being balanced.
Go
ahead.
Give it up. The Wayne situation was that, you know, he was on a private jet headed to Miami, and he had things on him.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, the pilot went in Karen mode and kind of called the police ahead of time when he landed, like, I'm with clients and they have guns on the plane. Da, 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 da. So of course he gets nabbed. He was already on probation. And what happens is his lawyer called up the governor of Florida and was like, can you do whatever you can do? Just help us. So the governor gets him off. And what happens is maybe a month before the elections, Wayne, pretty much, you know, Wayne's people got a call. Trump had said, like, get me any celebrity, anyone.
Last minute. I remember that.
Force me. Wow. Like, I need someone that's big in the black community. And And the governor remembered what he did for Wayne. And it was sort of like a you owe me thing. And what I believed happened was that Wayne went in thinking that it was a one-off photo op thing, did the photo op thing. And then it was sort of like the bait and switch. Will you travel with me and do the rest of the campaign? They were like, no, you said the one photo op thing. And then when that was broken, Trump got on the governor, and then the governor was like, well, I will just rescind your probation, whatever, and you got to go back to jail. And yeah, it was a way bigger story.
I was gonna ask, Rev, I was curious to know your work with younger activists, and what are some of the differences that you see between your generation and the younger generation of activists, be it, you know, Black Lives Matter or, you know, just any of the youth organizations now. And what are also some of the, I guess, some of the difficulties you have in dealing with the youth activists? Are they more receptive to listen to, you know, to take advice from an elder, or do they just seem to be like, oh, well, no, we want to do it our own way? How is that relationship for you?
Some of them during the Trayvon piece was tension. You know, we don't want to listen to the old guard. We want to make our name. And I kept telling them, I said, let me tell you something. These cameras are going to leave and we have to be organized. And gradually we started getting together. The three sisters that started Black Lives Matter, Alicia Garza, Sister Colors, all three of them and I started talking a lot. And they started seeing this thing was difficult. I started seeing their sincerity. So we worked together. They do my TV show. We talk. When I did a book last year, they did a book toward me virtually. Then you got some that's just out there that's totally wild. Then you have others that are sincere. And I tell them, there's no difference in y'all wanting to do it your way. I want to do it different than Jesse. Jesse did it different than Dr. King. That's part of life. But we are all in the same cause. And I must say, last year when we called the big march in Washington, and we are in the middle of a pandemic, we had 200,000 people, all of them came. And I told them, I don't have to put no shade on you. You ain't got to worry about me. I'm going to be out Sharpton anyway. I can help y'all. Y'all can help me, but you just can't do no violent stuff around me. And most of them are not violent. And I won't make you go to church if you won't throw a brick. Let's make a compromise. Mm-hmm. We kind of get along like that. I have a big youth department in my organization because I intend to, somebody's going to take my organization and go for it. So a lot of the thing, I have my youth work with their youth. They're the same age. Some of them are younger that are in National Action Network. And they've always been that. You had to remember in history, Jesse was with Dr. King. Stokely Carmichael and them was Black Power, was on the other side of the King thing. They were all the same age. John Lewis, Jesse Jackson, Stokely Carmichael, Rap Brown, all was the same age. There's always been differences in every generation. So a lot of the young activists say, we speak for the youth. No, you speak for some youth. Some youth still go to church. Some youth are nonviolent. I don't speak for all the elders. Everybody's got their piece. Work your piece and let's try to make something happen. And my thing is that it's a big highway out here. And as long as we don't switch lanes without a signal, we won't have an accident.
That's real.
Now, I was just going to say, remind me of that scene in Malcolm X that the Rev was in when they showed all aspects of what was going on.
Right.
Sorry.
But I'll tell you about that scene. I know we got to go, but I'll tell you about that scene. Spike Lee called me and asked me to do that scene. And I told him, you know that I was only 8 or 9 years old when I got killed. I'm just going to put you up there. Because Spike Lee, Russell Simmons, and I all grew up together in New York, getting known at around the same time. That's our generation. Spike's my generation. Spike about 2 years younger than me. So you see, I'm always mentioning Spike's movies. Denzel and I are the same age. That's our generation. And I can tease Denzel about, you know, John David's getting more parts than you now because all of us are older guys.
That explains you on the dance floor now. Now I get it. You was a hoe. Okay. All right. I see you on the dance floor a few times. Get off. Oh, yes. Everybody leave.
Rev, I want to know, you know, we live in a time now where, you know, the audacity of white supremacy is kind of proudly, you know,
rearing its head once again in ways that they haven't done since the 20s. My question isn't, did you ever think that it would ever come back to square one? I guess my question is, how can we finally nip this properly in the bud that we have not done now that we're back at square one?
I think that what we are seeing is a backlash like we never saw. There's always in history been a backlash after slavery, Reconstruction, and the backlash was the Klan. I think what makes this different is this is the first time you had somebody in the White House that actually fanned the flames to make them feel like nothing would happen to them. The law was on their side. And I think that the only way you're going to nip this in the bud is you're going to have some strong laws, and you're going to have to make examples of them to go to jail. They're going to have to do time. And then the others that feel that way will know, I may feel this way, but I won't be able to behave.
You won't do that no more.
Like black folks, penalty. like black folks.
That's right. That's how do you stop crime? You start perk walking some of them, and they will start learning how to obey and act like they got good sense.
Yes.
And that's what you got to do. And that's what I've told Biden. You got to make examples. Can't be no, you know, let's join hands and sing Kumbaya.
Kumbaya.
We go high.
We ain't going high.
Look at what they did. They start with a George Floyd, or they start with demonizing somebody like me. They run up in the Capitol, capital of the United States, and was walking around looking, calling for members of Congress to hurt them. If y'all don't put this in a real focus, a penalty, they'll come after you because they don't care unless you make them care. Some of them will have to do some real time.
Are there times like this, you know, even though you've, you know, worked your career as, you know, a nonviolent activist, are there times like this that really put that to the test for you? Like, you know, this time, any other times in your career where your nonviolent beliefs are really tested? Yeah, you want revenge or whatever.
Meaning you're nonviolent don't mean that you a punk and that you don't get angry. But you catch yourself, because I also feel like particularly like when we started this conversation, if I'm out there representing families, I can't let my emotions embarrass them. So if I go off on somebody, I'm hurting Eric Garner's family. I'm not just hurting Al Sharpton. You know, I'm hurting George Floyd's family. So I try not to misrepresent that. But my jaws get tight. There's a lot of times I won't even listen to talk radio. Because if I listen to some of the right-wing radio, what they say, I'll get out the car and make my next speech cussing everybody out, reacting to something they ain't heard, but I heard. You're human, but you got to try to discipline and keep telling yourself you're here for a reason, not a season. You got to last and uphold these people.
Ooh, thank you. Oh, thank you, Reverend.
I was curious, what was your relationship? Because I guess I was born in 78, so my earliest memories of you, believe it or not, we're from the Morton Downey Jr. show.
Dang.
Straight up.
That's the name of the
show. Like he come out. So, I mean, he was like, listeners, that, he would like, you know, this is like Jerry Springer before whatever. How much of that with him was that real? And because like you said, you know, in New York, I mean, you work the circuit, you see these guys all the time. How much of that of you and his relationship was like you guys really didn't like each other, and how much of it was kind of for the camera? What was y'all's dynamic like?
We didn't like each other at first. I think after a while, we sort of understood that he wanted me on for controversy and I wanted him on because the mainstream shows wasn't booking us then. So it was me using him to get our thing out there. And I remember years later, Mike Wallace did a thing with me in the early 90s on 60 Minutes. And he asked me, why did you do Morton Downey? I said, because you wouldn't interview me. As soon as I started getting mainstream, I left Morton Downey alone. But we started really not liking each other, but we kind of adjusted because I think it was equal use.
Yeah.
I see that. Mm. All right, my final question. I have to say that your health regimen has been very inspirational to me.
Yes.
And watching you, what was the decision to really get your health game together and to get your life right?
And how you kept it off during the Rona? How have you kept it off this stuff?
Well, you know, at first people used to do cartoons and all about me in the jogging suits and fat and all that. It didn't bother me. But as my daughters started getting older, I remember one day I was at the house and my youngest daughter, she was about five then, Ashley, she walked over to me and patted me on the belly and said, "Daddy, you fat." And that hurt me. And I started wanting to lose weight for her, and I lost a lot of weight. Then in 2001, I went and led a protest in Puerto Rico, you might remember, protesting the bombing in Vieques. And the federal judge gave me 90 days in jail. And I fasted 40 days, and I lost a lot of weight, and I felt better. And I started saying, you know what, I'm going to change my diet and keep it off. So jail made me go on a regimen. So I stopped eating meat, then I pushed back on starches and sugars, and then I started feeling better. I get more energy. I worked 16, 18-hour days, and it just gave me more energy. And right now, I only eat raw vegetables, raw fruits. I may eat fish one day a week, but no meat at all, no chicken. It was hard to give up chicken. A preacher not eat chicken. I used to eat chicken three meals a day.
But, man, I mean, how many fried chicken plates did you have to pass up?
Jesus. I was like, wait a minute.
From church mothers.
I ain't even doing that. What the hell?
That was hard. But and then, you know, a lot of people felt I lost weight to do TV. I had already lost the weight. I had no idea I'd have a TV show. But it became a way of life, and it doesn't bother me. I had that kind of willpower. I can sit down in front of people. They can have everything I used to love to eat. It doesn't bother me at all.
You are so amazing.
Amazing, man. That's what's up.
God damn it, Al Sharpton. You're the shit. I just, thank you. Thank you.
I thank you for doing this for me. I know your schedule's busy.
Yes. But,
no, I thank you, man. And I thank you for being you. You've been a real cultural influence. Even though you hurt my feelings once, because I brought my daughter, my daughter to 30 Rock. She's in her 30s now. Mm-hmm, she had a friend with her, and I was getting in the elevator, and her friend looked and said, "That's Questlove," and jumped off the elevator. And they never act like that around me, but they was trailing you. And I said, "This Negro got some nerve that he's a bigger act than I am at 30 Rock." That's Questlove.
When I first started coming there, I was all afraid. I'd be like, "Reverend Al, you just walk by." I was like, "I'm not big enough yet." thank you for doing our show. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Love you.
Thank you for being our Ghostbusters, for real.
Yes.
Thank you for all you've done, man.
Oh, I was just going to remind everybody to make sure that they watch Politics Nation every Saturday and Sunday.
Yes, on behalf of Team Supreme, Laia, Sugar Steve, Unpaid Bill, Montigolo. Yes, thank you very much, Reverend Al. I appreciate it. This is Questlove Supreme. We will see you on the next go-round. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, this is Sugar Steve. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS. And let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine. Hosted by me, Danielle Robey.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving
giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.